Welcome back to another episode of the Joel versus Arthritis podcast, or the Chronic Pain Club if you're watching us live on Twitch, where we do this at twitch.tv/Joel versus Arthritis if you want to get involved with the conversation live. This week I am delighted to be joined by James Hillary, who's a patient that lives with ankylosing spondylitis, and you may recognise him from the Great British Bake Off, even though I've promised him tonight I'm trying not to introduce him as James from the Great British Bake Off. So, James, welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well.
Yeah, all good, thank you. And thank you for inviting me along.
Brilliant. And yeah, just thank you for having these open conversations, because they really do. I appreciate people don't see the DMs and the messages and things we get from the back of the podcast and everything, but it really does make a difference, you know, whether somebody who's their first experience, or they feel like nobody else understands, or they just want to share it with a family member to help them understand a little bit. So yeah, what you're doing here is really helping people, so thank you for joining us.
Oh, more than welcome. And I think it's good to have more men out there advocating, because when I was looking for advice, a majority of the people will talk about chronic illness are generally female, because they're comfortable talking about it. So the more men that talk about it, I think there'll be more coming out of the woodworks as they feel it's a safer space to start talking about these sorts of things.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it is getting better. Like, when I started all of this, it actually felt worse in the pandemic, because you had loads of people like take to Instagram and stuff, like, you know, you had lots of people taking up baking, which I'm sure we'll come on to, but you also had lots of people taking up to like likes of Instagram and decided to start sharing their journey. And that was very sort of female heavy. There just weren't that many men talking about, especially like the mental health side and how that impacts us. And I'm sure we'll get on to that. So yeah, thank you, because I must admit, I tried to have as much diversity in our guests as possible, but it isn't easy finding people that are sort of willing males to share this stuff. So thank you for joining us and raising awareness of that. So before we get into sort of like the chronic illness stuff and what you've done on the telly and all this sort of thing, do you want to maybe just tell us a bit about who James is before all the bit that people know from online and media personality? Who's James? Tell us a little bit about what used to be before your condition, and feel free to take as long as you like. You don't have to worry about time.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. So I guess most of us have a pre and post condition life. Understanding I had ankylosing spondylitis. As a youngster, I was always very fit and active, loved being outdoors, riding bikes over the park. It was in the good old days where you'd disappear for a day, no one had phones, and your parents just hope you get back at some stage. So I had a lot of freedom. And as I went into my career, which was banking, I started in London banking at 16. I needed some outlets to do something different rather than just sitting at a desk 9 to 5. So I got into the Royal Naval Reserves. I always wanted to learn how to dive. So I joined the Royal Naval Reserves, and their branch was in London, to become a port diver. It was in the time of the Cold War, and our job would be to protect our ports, probably quite relevant now with the Russia situation, from mines and ordnance that may be placed in them that would stop our shipping. The Royal Navy diving course is probably the toughest course in the Royal Navy, apart from becoming a Royal Marine, which is a 9-month course. So it was a big challenge for me. We used to run across London Bridge and Tower Bridge in our dry suits, scared the life out of the tourists. We had a blast. We used to dive mostly over the sort of around the South Coast. But we went up to Liverpool, North Shields, South Shields. We got to dive all over the place, and we had a fantastic time. So that group of divers that I trained to dive with when I was 18, 33 years on, we still meet up for a pint and reminisce about our time. It was such a great bonding experience. So I've always done fun things like that. After joining the reserves, I was probably in there for about 9 years. I started doing some running, and eventually worked up to do some marathons, multiple triathlons. I was fortunate that I got to live in Chicago for 3 years, late 90s, early 2000s. And they had a really good scene of what they called adventure racing then, we'd know it as the tough mudders over here, or
yeah, I know, yeah.
Muddy type running things. The US were kind of a little bit ahead of the game. So me and a friend, he was built like a whippet from Yorkshire, love fell running, can run ultra marathons. And I was like the shire horse of our partnership. But generally they were team events. And we did some brilliant events around Chicago. There was one that was a 12-hour event, and we had to go and learn how to roll a blade. And there was all different aspects to it. So we just had a blast. But then I started to realise with all the training that I was doing that I was getting tired. Fatigued. I'm more fatigued than I thought I should have been for the level of exercise I was doing. And that started, I guess, to get me to think, there's probably something not quite right. And I was getting to the stage where we just had a couple of kids. So part of it, I put it down to sleepless nights,
yeah.
Obviously running around after three, four-year-olds.
Late.
it's just like, I'm getting old. I've got kids and I'm getting old. I put it down to that. But eventually in 2012, when I was training for the London Marathon, it was probably the first time I realised I needed to go and see someone about it. So I went to our doctor, who I've been so fortunate that we've got a brilliant GP who's really thorough. And he did the usual blood tests, so my B12 deficient, folic acid, all the usual stuff. And most of my bloods were coming back pretty normal. And he said, well, I'll refer you to a rheumatologist. Unfortunately, because the job that I had a private healthcare. So to speed things up, I went down the private route to see a rheumatologist who, again, was very thorough in his investigations. And I to this day, I still remember the first interaction I had with him. And I walked in, I said, look, I'm suffering with chronic fatigue. That's why I'm here. I've been training for the London Marathon. I'm exhausted after any of my long runs at the weekend. And he looked at me and he says, does your lower back hurt? And I'm like, I don't care about my back. I've got kids. I'm old. I'm worried about my fatigue. That's what I'm here for. And he went, hold up a minute. I think there's a different problem. And that's just one of the symptoms of it. And so he did some blood tests to check out my HLBA27 gene. And I was positive for that gene, which is a good marker that you have ankylosing spondylitis. He did the nuclear bone scanning, where I went to the pub that night and I had bright yellow urine and urine and scared everyone there. And then did some MRIs, and he could see that there were some Romanus lesions, shiny corners of the lower spine, and inflammation in the SI joints. And he turned around and said, well, your fatigue is because you've got ankylosing spondylitis. And because I'd obviously been holding this in for a long time before I got the bravery to go to a doctor's, I was kind of relieved that I had a name for what's wrong with me. Because once I've got something that I can sort of hang my hat on, I can go and try and fix it. It is generally my mentality. I'm a problem solver.
People feel guilty for feeling that way, but it's a really common experience, at least knowing what you're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. And it was kind of a relief back to the mental health thing. I was worried it was just in my mind and no one would believe me.
Yeah.
So the rheumatologist was fantastic. If you've ever been through private health care, the second you're diagnosed with a long-term condition, you're pushed straight back to primary care through the NHS, which fortunately, at the time, the rheumatologist that saw me privately was also a local rheumatologist who he moved me just to his NHS book, so I had continuity of a rheumatologist. He, within probably, so we started through the starting drugs for someone with AS, which is non-steroidal anti-inflammatories,
yeah,
painkillers, start slowly, and then we worked up through methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and I'm now on biologics,
yeah,
which was a long journey from 2012 to now to get onto biologics, which are and were life-changing for me.
Yeah.
I think I've put it that bravely. But sadly, the rheumatologist I had retired. So I then had to find a new rheumatologist. And I think many people I've spoken to with ankylosing spondylitis can find it very frustrating to find a rheumatologist, and I'm sorry if there's any rheumatologists listening, that still care. The older rheumatologists, you can see they've been beaten down by the system and they just had their standard playbook that they would put you through.
Yeah.
So I ended up having to learn about my condition and advocating for myself, because I couldn't trust some of the rheumatologists that I was talking to were really thinking about how I could get the improvement that I needed.
Yeah, that's a horrible place to be in. And like, as somebody that's had a really consistent team, I think sort of my experience is similar, but I sort of see it slightly different in that because I had arthritis as a child, when I was a kid, it felt like everything was thrown at it, you know, because it's not just because you're an interesting case. You know, there is an element of that. You know, I only had to see how many students I used to be paraded in front of every single appointment, which was really awkward when you're a teenage boy and they all want to sort of feel your joints and yeah, just it was just uncomfortable. But it's not just you're an interesting case, but it's because I think there's still a chance there to minimize impact and get ahead of it and all that sort of thing. And there is definitely that. Well, I experience it slightly differently, but when you then get into adulthood, you kind of get to that point where, okay, it's just a management game now. It's a case of, you know, we've got to try and keep a lid on it as much as we can. And that's soul destroying, isn't it? And whether you take that as perceiving that the individual doesn't care or they don't have enough time to care, which I think is a lot of the issue in the NHS, it's a horrible thought, because without that education, it's really difficult for you to make decisions and informed decisions and play an active part in your management, your condition, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think you need to kind of grasp that power yourself and get that understanding to feel that you can, I guess, explain the best way possible in that 5 minutes that you get with a rheumatologist. You've got to maximise your the quality of that time when you get to see a consultant. So I had a consultant after I'd been through a couple of really decent rheumatologists that I turned up, and he recommended that I just take paracetamol. So I immediately then started looking for another rheumatologist, because I could barely walk at that stage. I'm like, you're not really taking this seriously.
And the thing that focus on the medication, because with something like AS, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in detail, like the importance of physio and physical activity and movement and stretches and, you know, even if you had the best drugs in the world, you wouldn't maintain a good quality of life if you didn't do all that other stuff with AS, you know.
Exactly. And it's all that other stuff that really makes a difference. The drugs may enable you to exercise a little bit more or stretch a bit more, but unless you're doing that, I remember, the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society, that I now think is called the National Axial Spa Society, because that's the new trendy word for it, run branches for fellow sufferers across the UK. And it's a kind of a self-led physio class. You have a physiotherapist there. People with your condition come together once a week, do some stretching, share experiences. And that was brilliant and very eye-opening of the number of people who didn't understand the condition that they had and understand that it's different for everyone. Just because we've all got this same name, we're all in different phases of it, have different challenges with our disabilities. But there was one physio there, Aberdeen, who was fantastic. And I asked him in the first few weeks, I said, when will the pain stop? And he said to me, well, the pain will stop when your spine fuses together. That's not much good, is it?
It's a horrible thought, isn't it? It's a sickening thought.
Yeah, it is. But and then he went on to say, just like, if you think of it like a frost on an autumn night and you see a puddle outside and it's got a little crinkling of ice on the top, if you go out and stamp on that in the morning, it will still be water at night. If you leave it, it's just going to freeze thicker and thicker and thicker. So he said, physio is stamping on that little crinkling of ice and keeping you moving. And he said, you'll be much, much better the more you move, even if it hurts. And that, I think, was something that's always resonated with me. And as I say, motion is lotion, or to rest is to rust, I think it's the German expression.
You need to hear that as well, though, because, like, you know, I don't always get the best response when I reply to people in my DMs. People focus so much on the pain, and of course they do. It's all consuming and it affects our mental health and everything else. But with something like ankylosing spondylitis, where I suppose I should probably say at this point for anyone that's listening, it's basically, if you consider it like arthritis of the spine, but there's like the real key thing with AS is that it leads more often than not, doesn't it, to vertebrae, spinal fusion.
Yeah.
So you basically become rigid and lose your movement. So in a condition like AS, yes, the pain is obviously going to be all-consuming, but like you're saying there, you kind of need to hear that from your physio, that the pain is a necessary thing if you want to retain that mobility. And I think sometimes as patients, we could probably help the medical community have more confidence in telling us what we don't want to hear, because if it's, you know, because as long as it's well explained, like it was in yours, and you got an awesome like metaphor there or whatever, and sort of analogy for it, then that can help you. Like I say, it goes back to being educated again, doesn't it, about your condition? Because otherwise, if it's just take this painkiller, it's a very sort of one-way ticket with something like ankylosing spondylitis, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that the thing you just want to do is lay down and make the pain go away, and that's the worst possible thing. And don't get me wrong, there's some weekends I say, blow it, I'm going to lay down for the weekend, that's it, I'm done. I'll fight this fight next week. And I think you have to do that at times just for your own resilience and mental capacity. But other days when I'm feeling good, I love hiking out in the local parks, and the dog takes me out more than I take him out. So he wears me out while I wear him out. He's a mad little cockapoo. But again, it's keeping that moving. But it is interesting that conversely, when I went to my second or third rheumatologist, so this would have been probably 2014, one of the healthcare professionals there said, I should stop running, I should stop exercising, I'm just damaging my back more. And I think that was the worst advice I was ever given. Luckily, the physio that I was talking about, who gave me the nice analogy about the frost, I met after, and he said, no, that's a load of rubbish, get moving. It's a listen to your body, do what you can when you can, but don't stop, because you'll never start again. And I guess 2012 is what led me ultimately, because I did the London Marathon. I tore my calf muscle on the Tower Bridge, which is about halfway, and I'm a stubborn sod, and I finished, and I said, I'll never do one of those again, and I signed up probably 2 weeks later for the next one, and I run it again 2 years later.
That mindset is powerful, though, isn't it? Knowing that this could be the last time I could do it, and having that sort of sense of reality of your condition, because my rheumatoid, we said before we went live, you know, I spent a lot of my teenage years and years in my 20s thinking I had AS, turned out to be psoriatic sort of arthritis. And my rheumatologist was exactly the same. You will lose it, so just keep going. And his first question, sometimes it'd be really frustrating, but his first question at the start of every consultation was, how's the hockey going? Or how's the running going? And if you'd had months when you'd been laid up, it was the worst question in the world to hear, and you just wanted to throw something. But I know, as an older person now and a lot more life experience and everything, I know why he asked that, because he's basically saying, I'm green-lighting you to push yourself as much as you can do, because there will come a time when you can't. And that's a hard thing to get your head around. But do you not find, like, with that marathon, that like if you're already stubborn, it's only going to make you more stubborn, I think.
Exactly, yeah. And it's, stubbornness gets people a long way. On 2014, when I did the London Marathon, I wasn't particularly fit. But, again, my stubbornness got me round, not my athletic capability. but it was, again, worth doing. Sadly, I was meant to be. I've actually got a place in the London Marathon this weekend, but I won't be able to run it, and I've had to cancel it. But the last 9-12 months has been quite horrendous for pain, because whilst I got all the, I'll step back a little bit and I'll get to why I won't be running. So after my paracetamol scenario with a rheumatologist, I talked to the guys at the NAS group, say, look, who's got a really good physio and rheumatologist and physio team that you can recommend? Because I'm fed up with just picking one out of a book out of the GP's list. I need someone who actually understands it. And one of the ladies that I used to train with said, oh, Whipps Cross Hospital in the East End of London has got a brilliant team. They're very forward thinking. So I asked my doctor to switch me to them. I was probably at one of my lowest points when I got to see the team at Whipps Cross. And you first speak to a rheumatologist. Sorry, not a rheumatologist, a physiotherapist, before you even get to talk to the rheumatologist. And I was basically, I broke down in tears. I'll admit it. I knew what I had. I knew there were drugs out there that would help me. But the experiences I'd had with other rheumatologists had left me really frustrated and kind of feeling abandoned. And I just literally said, look, I'm at my wit's end now. I'm in so much pain. I really don't know what to do. I know what I need, but I need a rheumatologist to believe that's what I need to get me the drugs that I need, which are the biologics, which are in immune suppressants. They use them broadly in psoriatic arthritis as well, similar drug, exactly the same drugs, in fact. And this physiotherapist looked at me. She looked me in the eyes and she could see how low I was at that point, walked straight out of the consultant room and got the senior consultant rheumatologist and said, we need to get this guy on Humira as soon as possible. What do we do? Fortunately, they were running a drug trial for Humira versus another drug that's coming out that was being used to treat psoriatic arthritis. And they looked at me and we went through sort of discussions of MRIs that I've had. And the rheumatologist looked at my elbows. He said, how long have you had psoriatic arthritis? And I went, I've never been diagnosed with it. He said, well, I can see looking at your fingernails. I had really bad elbows, yeah, and not as bad at the moment. He said, you've probably had it most of your life. I said, well, I was told I had eczema as a child. Actually, if I look back, it was probably psoriasis, not eczema.
I had eczema as a child, and then it turns as you get sort of like adult puberty. So that's how I was expecting. Like, I'm not medically trained, but I had it all the time behind my ears. And I was like, well, was that psoriasis?
Oh, I used to have that.
And I was like, was that psoriasis? So no, typically as children that you get eczema, but then that kind of sets on a tone. But the crossover between ankylosing spondylitis and psoriatic arthritis is so the whole reason I went for nearly 20 years thinking I, you know, under every assumption that I was living with AS was because it affects the same, you know, the neck, the back, is it the SI joints? Because I can never say that word, and my wife always laughs every time I try to pronounce that sacroiliac or whatever. Yeah, I just, I don't know, maybe it's a Norfolk accent thing. I've never been able to say that word. But the same as the heels in AS, you get lots of issues with the heels. You get that in psoriatic arthritis and feet problems and that. So there's so many overlaps. And like you say, we're even on the same medication for two totally different conditions.
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose at least you were already on the right drugs for it when you discovered that.
Yeah. So they got me on this drug test within probably 2 months, barely. And then they put, and it was a blind drug test, so I didn't know whether I was on the new drug or Humira. When they unblinded it, I found out I was on Humira. But literally within 2 weeks of taking Humira, I barely had any pain. Inflammation had gone down in all my joints and also in my hands. It was life changing. I could get out running again. I could do the things I enjoyed. Sadly, probably just before Christmas just gone, it stopped working. I'd been on it for 3.5 years, and it just, the efficacy went down. My back started getting back inflamed. The SI joints were back and felt like they had glass in them. So I had to leave the drug trial and get back into the NHS circuit to work on the next biologic drug, which is, Cosentyx is the brand name. I can't pronounce.
I don't keep up. So I'm on Humira myself. So I try not to learn how to pronounce all the other. As for them all ending in MAB, it doesn't make it the easiest words to say the actual drug name. But there's lots of crossover. And there is a lot of unfortunately, that experience is really common. So I was similar to you. Within a couple of weeks of taking mine, I was pain-free. Within a month, all my rashes just melted, which was like, I thought, is this placebo? And then when I saw my rashes go, it was like, wow, this really isn't in my head. And yeah, I can't remember how many years I was on it. And then it's the F. So I'm still on it because it does something. Yep. And I'm scared to change it. And I think at this point, it's probably important that we mentioned, like you were saying about, you know, you want to get through to the good stuff. And that's, again, why I think it really helps when patients are informed. Because I had a lot of really good years on methotrexate. I know lots of people have really horrible experiences. And I'm not saying it was easy. And I threw up a lot and lost hair from my eyebrows and things like that. But it, for a lot of years, it controlled it. But the thing is, we're kind of on this like gauntlet run, aren't we? That as you tick off those drugs and go higher up that chain, your options get less and less. And when you have a taste of something that works, like in your case, how much harder is that fall when it stops working?
Yeah, it's catastrophic. It's the hardest thing. And you're right. It's whilst I know where I wanted to get to on the what I call the good drugs, but you're right, methotrexate and sulfasalazine are brilliant as well on that journey. When I was coming off of the drug trial, they basically said to me, and this is the bit I should have asked more questions about when I started the drug trial, is what happens when I finish it? Because it was doing enough to keep the inflammation in my hands and my feet down. And as you know, when you're going for your checkups, they need to see so many inflamed joints.
So first thing they look is your hands.
Hands, feet, yeah, and shoulders. And it's always my back that has most pain. They said, we can't count that. So they said, we're going to have to re-diagnose you, take you back off of the PSA route and put you back into ankylosing spondylitis unless you want to hang around for 6 months until you get inflamed again, and then we can re-diagnose you as PSA. And I said, this is
what a choice.
Yeah. But the scary thing is they said, if you wait 6 months and you're on PSA, you still have four other drugs that we can prescribe to you if Cosentyx doesn't work. On AS, because there's not as many drugs approved for it at the moment, there'll be more coming. I'm on the last drug now. And back to what you were saying is we want to get to the end goal. But my ultimate fear now is if this doesn't work, I haven't got a plan B. Or plan B is pain management.
But the thing is, I'm looking at very little information as an outsider. And again, I repeat, guys, I'm not medically trained or anything and don't claim to be. But that, in order to have the best chance of success on that journey, it needs to be the whole picture. So like when you're explaining your experience with rheumatologists and maybe not getting access to physio early enough and all that sort of stuff, them drugs only work when the whole package is working with it, you know? So yeah, burning through, like, so I've been on sulfasalazine since I was 12 and it continues to do something. And if I just took that away, biologics on its own wouldn't work for me. So even though I call it a miracle drug, on its own, it's still pretty ineffective. It has to be combined with something for me. But the reason, you know, having mine so young, we were able to do a long sort of progression through those options was because the whole package was there. So when people like yourself have that negative experience where either the rheumatologist isn't invested and they're saying take paracetamol and you're not looking at hydrotherapy and physiotherapy and being educated about the importance of exercise and that, then of course people burn through those. And I think in the UK you have to have like active signs of disease in two or more joints and all that jazz. Well, it's not going to take long to get to that point to access biologics if you haven't been well supported earlier in the process. And it just worries me. Are we just bottling up a bigger issue for 20, 30 years down the line when all of us are much older and we're just hoping new things come along, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting. So hydrotherapy, I found fantastic. The warmth of the pool being supported.
Yep.
But the number of pools that have been closed and the number of pools that have been closed through lockdown, as I would say, as some hospitals using it as an opportunity to get rid of something that costs them a lot of money, definitely with a hospital that I've been at previously, Basildon, the availability of that care is so limited now.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse. You think of the energy bills and stuff. But so that was by far my most horrible experience. So when I was a kid, I was diagnosed officially with AS at 14, diagnosed with PSA in its place when I was in my mid-20s. But hydro was like essential. And I'm not saying it was perfect because back then I used to have to get into a pool with pensioners, which looking back as a kid, that probably wasn't appropriate, but it had this real impact. They used to admit me to the ward, and for a week, every day, I'd go in the pool, and I would come out of there 2 weeks out of hospital, 2 weeks later or whatever, feeling 10 times better. And then as soon as my diagnosis changed, I remember ringing up and saying, can I get access to Hydra? I said, no, it's just for AS patients. And I get why you have to prioritise it. But it's like, but I've got a track record of this therapy working. Why would you give that up just because a label has changed? I don't get it. But yeah, it's across the board, access to hydrotherapy is just impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, the labels that we get given, but PSA and AS are kissing cousins. And a lot of people have both.
Yeah, they really do.
So we should be allowed to have multiple personalities in our ailments and get all the treatment that we need that is beneficial to us.
And especially since the discovery you mentioned earlier, I'm never going to remember, HLA-27 gene, whatever it is. I did write that. HLA-B27. I missed out one letter. Yeah. I nearly got it. Since that was discovered, because I remember, like, as soon as that blood test was available and they'd done it, it said, oh, you're negative, and it, like, AS got chucked out. That's not the case for everyone. I know they can hang a lot on that gene being present in that test, but there are plenty of people that have got AS with that negative, and that sort of thing worries me, you know what I mean? Because I got told recently I got the start of what looks like fusing in my neck, and I thought to myself, how ironic would it be that 20 years later, AS is present after going through that merry-go-round. But yeah, it's great that they got more of a definitive test for something like AS, but we're also got to remember there are plenty of people out there who have rheumatoid arthritis that don't show inflammation markers in their bloods, and you know, that sort of thing, isn't it?
And that was one of the challenges I had. My inflammation markers were really low, even when I was at my most pain. So they were high enough to notice that there was something wrong, but they weren't off the charts like some people are. And that also makes it harder when you're trying to get a clear diagnosis. And it can depend on where you are in kind of your, whether you're having a flare up or whether it's a better month or a couple of months. It's a tricky one.
And it affects your well-being and mental health. Like, we have both independently already tonight, I noticed, said things like, I thought it was in my head, or I'm glad it wasn't in my head. And with something like AS, you can be in so much pain, and all right, a picture, an imaging, you know, sometimes x-rays don't show it, but an MRI will, or vice versa. You can be in absolutely crippling pain. You know, I was in a wheelchair as a kid, and I had nothing to show for it. My joints didn't flare. My blood tests looked fine. And people don't understand the pressure that then puts on you and how you perceive your condition. And I'd probably argue, I might be wrong, but I'd probably argue it's worse for men as well, because we're seeing, you know, society and things wants us to be strong and swallow our issues and you know, be the cornerstone of the family and so much pressure when you haven't got something. Like, I actually welcome a psoriasis outbreak these days because I can point to it and say, that's what's going on inside, you know? So did you experience that?
Yeah, definitely. There'll be days where I could barely walk and they'll do an MRI. And, oh, we can't see any inflammation. It's just like, but I know how much pain is in those two SI joints. I'm amazed that you can't see it. It's tough because also they'll show you the images and they still mean nothing to me.
Yeah,
I know where my SI joint is in relation to my hips, but show me an MRI and I've got no idea what I'm looking at and how they tell it's inflamed or it's not.
It's different pictures do different things as well. Like, I learned recently at a conference, somebody was telling me, and so I've only got one source for this, but they were saying, like, well, x-rays will only show historic damage. So when your rheumatologist says, oh, we'll get an x-ray, that's only going to show historic damage. It's not going to show the live MRIs, apparently, what shows the live active inflammation. And again, how have I lived with arthritis over 20, 25 years and not known that? But if we'd be given that information, we're not going to tell doctors what to do, and we're not going to take their jobs away from them or anything. But it's just that having an option. Oh, if you're going to do a scan, maybe do this one, or can you tell me the difference between the two so I can be a little bit more informed, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's and it can be that route to, because they'll see the, as you say, they'll see the fusion on there where it's too late to do anything, whereas the MRI picks it up so much earlier and they can see the the softer tissues and the joints. And so it's brilliant technology. I remember probably about 5-6 years ago, I was in so much pain. I went back to the private healthcare, so that I was allowed to see him for bad flare-ups. And I said, is there anything you can do? And I've had steroid injections in my bum, the usual sort of stuff before. I said, it'll work for a month or two. And they said, there's one thing we can do, which is a CT scan. And what they do is they put the needles right into the joints under CT scan so they can get exactly where the inflammation is.
That sounds pleasant.
They didn't tell me how painful it was, quite rightly, because I would run a million miles. Just the injections to numb me before they put the steroids in, I nearly hit the ceiling. And when the nurse holds both your hands, you know you're in for a fright. Yeah.
My wife has had a front row seat of me having my knees injected and knows how much I struggle with that. Ever since I was a kid, that really has always been super painful. I have to have a pillow to bite down on and everything. Yeah. And you're trying to remind yourself that this is for the sort of the greater good. And like for anyone who's had a depot steroid, like in the backside, like you, like everyone knows how awesome that is. For a month, you feel like you can run a marathon. And I understand there's long-term effects again, but it goes back to that biologics thing you were saying, where like the more well-controlled it is, the harder the fall when these things stop working. And I've almost got to that place now where I'd rather just have a constant. If I'm in just like, you know, medium pain all the while, I can manage that. It's the peaks and troughs of something like AS that people don't understand. Like, do you want to maybe explain a little bit about like what's it like? Because AS, you get like lots of stiffness, don't you, when you wake and things like that. And how different can two of your days be, and what that looks like?
Yeah, so they can be night and day. So that, as I said, the last 9 months has been hellish for me. So it will probably take me half hour in the morning just to kind of roll myself out of bed, because like my whole spine and my hips seize up. So I need to stretch a bit, just get myself going. The worst thing, and this sounds really daft, is putting on my pants. I can put one leg in, fine. It's lifting that second leg in, barely, what, half a centimetre off the floor, just to flip your foot through the hole. And I'd scream out in pain. It was just a little movement in my hip joint that just like would kill me every morning. So my experience of ankylosing spondylitis is a majority of the pain is in the SI joint, which is, if you think of the butterfly of the hips, it's that triangular bone that joins your spine to the hips. And then in the lumbar spine, so the bottom two, so L5 and L4, are really tender and sore. I do get inflammation in my hands and my shoulders. And ankylosing spondylitis can affect anywhere where tendon touches bone. So it can even affect your eyes where tendons attach. But generally, it's through the spine. And once the drugs stop working, it becomes incredibly painful to do anything for any period of time. So sitting down for more than half an hour in an office chair, I'll be in agony. So I'll go and lay on the floor, stretch my back out. Then after half hour, that's painful. So I'll move around. Generally, moving is the best thing, even if I'm just walking kind of backwards and forwards. So every day is a struggle just to kind of keep myself down, as you're saying, to an acceptable level of pain. And that may be a 5 or 6 on the scale. And I can live with that. And most people go, really? And it's just like, yeah, because I'm hitting the 9s. And I always put a 10 as I had kidney stones last year. And I had 3 shots of morphine and it didn't touch the pain. So I now can't say I'm in a 10 with AS. I've downgraded it to a 9 on a bad day. But trying to explain to people that what it's like just existing with that pain is really hard. And I must admit, I've worked for the same company for 24 years. Last year before Christmas was probably the first time I really opened up to my boss and said, look, this is what's going on. Fortunately, I've been in really good health and I've never really had any sick time off in the 23 previous years. But this year, I think I've had more time off sick since I've started work. And I find, back to mental health, I find that really struggling because I'm always felt like I'm a bit of an overachiever and I always want to deliver and I always want to support people well. And having to stop and admit that I can't do everything that I think I can in my brain was really hard on me this year. And I think that really hit my mental health. And I probably don't speak about it enough to my family when it's impacting me, because again, we have to man up, be that rock. My kids are now 17 and 12. I still want to take them to tennis. I stupidly, when we was in Spain on holiday in May, wanted to go jet. My eldest son wanted to go jet skiing. Yeah. I knew that was the worst decision I could make this year or probably this decade. And I'm like, sod it. I'm going to cram in the painkillers and I'm going to go and enjoy myself for a day. I'll pay for it for 2 days after. But you still want to do things, and it's become so frustrating personally. And I know you've talked about this on social media, when your kids are there and you want to do something with them. And I'm lucky my kids are at an age they can understand a lot more, and they realize that if I'm grumpy, it's not because I'm grumpy with them at times. Maybe I'm just having a high pain day, and they're really good. But I know how hard it was when they were younger trying to say, I really can't do that, or please don't jump on my back today. As much as I know you're going to do it 15 times during the day, please try not to do it today.
And it is soul destroying, and nobody treats that. You know, everyone's focusing on the pain, and you know, I'm the same. When I have to call in sick for work, it destroys me far more than the pain does. But I know I physically aren't going to get through the day, even if I'm sitting at the desk. And that it's like a second illness I then experience, that second punch to the guts, like, of how useless I feel, and I'm not contributing, or I'm letting people down, and nobody treats that. And I was similar to you with, like, you know, a couple of months back, my son wanted to run. We were on a new estate, and there's this bit where they're building, and I'm not advocating that you take your kids to building sites. I never realised how that sounded, but a space where we could just run around without any traffic. And that was the first time I couldn't keep up with him. He's only three, and that proper upset me. I come back, like, welling up. And stupidly, I'm gonna get back to running. I'm gonna run Norwich 10K. I used to always do it until I needed my knees injected a week before, and then it all went downhill. And signed up for that. I'm now like 4 weeks away, and I'm already in the back of my mind know that I cannot do it. I've tried going out. I used to run 10, 11 miles. Then a couple of years ago, I could at least do 5. Last year, I think I managed 3. All the runs I've tried, I can't get past like a mile and a half without being in so much pain. I know the hope of me doing 6 is just not going to happen. But people forget that with this condition, as your body fails you, your mind is still the same, and you're still the same person that you was before. And that conflict, for me, is far more damaging than anything this disease can do to our joints.
Definitely, yeah. And again, another side that doesn't get treated holistically with this condition.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pain in your back, now get on with it. It affects you. So many facets in how it will affect you. Me asking for help has always been tough. I think I've learned over the last 12 months that I need to at times ask for help, and I need to open up more. And I'm finding it easier each time I do it, but it's admitting, it sounds daft, but it's admitting to myself that I'm disabled and I don't like that.
And because it's something that evolves, you know, and just because you might have had experiences with flares and stuff in the past doesn't make it any easier. Like I say, I was in a wheelchair as a kid, and then I had 10, 15 years where I was completely normal. I know that's a horrible word to use, but it was completely normal, and I toured in bands, and I played sport, and I'd done all this stuff. So then when that came back, people think that you're going to adjust to it again because, I even had a doctor say it to me once, well, at least you're not back in a wheelchair, as if that was some sort of acceptable benchmark. I was like, no, because I've just had that taste of what I could be doing as a person. So it's why I struggle when people sort of like, you know, if you can fully embrace it, then great. But for me, because of that flare remission cycle, I will always be reminded of these two lives I could leave. Yeah. And unfortunately, we tend, inevitably, as we get older and the condition progresses, we live more and more in that body we don't want to be in, don't we?
Definitely, yeah, very true.
Well, thank you for sharing. I'm really conscious of your time, because I know if my physio was watching this, making somebody with AS sit for 45 minutes and not move, I'd be getting in the neck. But I obviously have to ask you, because I would be stupid if I thought everybody was here for the ankylosing spondylitis chat. I have to ask you about the whole Bake Off experience and what that was like. And I suppose probably more importantly related to our conversation tonight, I'm guessing there was an element of motivation from these, the experiences that pushed you towards that. So do you want to share a bit of that?
Yeah, love to. So my, when the person told me that I shouldn't run ever again, that was kind of my mental health outlet, that I'd love to go for a long run, just think about nothing, be in my own headspace, bit of peace. So I needed to find something else to do to give me that relaxation from the day job. I always used to bake as a kid with my dad. He worked nights, so on a weekend, we'd always be in the kitchen baking something. It would generally go wrong, but we'd have a good laugh. It was a happy time and a nice place where we just caught up and chatted. So I thought, and I've always loved the Bake Off. So when I was told not to run again, I probably started watching the Bake Off again. And I thought, my little competitive nature thought, I could probably be all right on that. I wouldn't be the best, but I know I wouldn't be the worst. So it took me a year. And then I decided that, well, what have I got to lose? I'll apply for it. And the first time I applied, I didn't get on. I got a little way through the application process, which is quite long in itself. And I thought, I'll reapply a second year. And if I don't get on it the second year, that's fine. At least I've tried. And the second year, kind of the process is that you have to do a long written application that end up about 12 A4 pages of what have you baked, send us pictures, why did you bake, who are you, what do you usually love doing, and all that sort of stuff. And I never mentioned my AS on it at all. I did mention I had a bad back, but I didn't really quantify it more than that. And I think the last line, I used to ride a motorbike as well, and the last line I put in the application, which thought I need to leave it with something that stands out, is that I'm a big, bald banker from Brentwood with a buggered back who loves his motorbike. And I thought, putting that in there, at least they'll remember me. And fortunately, they called me back, and there's some phone interviews, and then you have to take some sweet and savoury bakes up. You talk to the food team, you talk to producers. And every time I had another conversation, I thought they're going to find me out soon and kick me out of the process. But I got all the way to the end. And you have to do like the technical challenge in a kitchen with, I think there was about 20 of us. So kind of they started off with about 14,000 applications, and they whittle you down to the last 70 do the technical challenge, around 70 or 80. And then then out of those, they'll pick the 12 bakers and two substitutes in case anyone drops out, if they're ill or something like that. So I got through all this process, and then I got to the stage where you have to go and see a show psychologist because of social media. They want to make sure that you're kind of mentally robust enough for being heckled on Twitter and all that fun stuff that might or might not come about. So I got through that fine, and then they said, oh, we just need to talk about your medical health because it's long days filming. And that's where I said, well, actually, I've got a condition called ankylosing spondylitis. It affects my back. I get pain, stiffness, but I'm being treated. I think I was on methotrexate at the time and pain, anti-inflammatories and painkillers. I said, it's manageable. I'm fine. I said, oh, we'll need a letter from your doctor to okay it. So I went to a doctor, and he said, I don't know why they ask you to ask me to write this letter. He said, the only person who knows whether you can do it is you. And if you say yes, I'm going to write it because I want to know someone off the Bake Off. And to the day, my doctor will always talk about the Bake Off and his wife, who's the nurse, about me being on the Bake Off. So I got through the whole process. I didn't, I guess, comprehend how long the days will be and how much standing around there'll be. So the first weekend, we filmed pretty much every weekend. I left after episode 5, so about halfway through. And we would start at the place we filmed about 5:30 in the morning. We'd make sure we got all our ingredients on our benches that you see in the tent. We'd go and have some breakfast. And then there's lots of kind of filming, you walking into the tent, standing around. And then you do your challenge, which will be timed, so it may be a 2-hour challenge. Then people have got to clear up after you. Another thing I didn't think about, I thought you just kind of baked it, put it on the side, and then they judged it straight away. But yeah, the carnage in the tent after you got 12 bakers who who have been panic baking. There's flour, there's stuff everywhere. So they tied it all up for the judging. So we were filming probably 5:30 in the morning, and we would finish. I think there were some days we finished at 10, just because there's so much kind of in TV, lots of action and then lots of waiting. And I think my back held up pretty well. I remember on, I think it was Bread Week. So normally the judges come in, as you see the tent on the telly, where you're looking at all the benches with all the bakers staring at you. At the back, there's a sunrise kind of bit of set.
Wide shot sort of thing they do.
Exactly. And just behind there is kind of where all the producers sit, and they've got, and the dishwashers. So there's a tent around the back of the tent, in effect, which is like the little hub. We're never allowed to go in it. And every time I've seen Paul come into the tent, he'll always come in through that front bit and say hello. But for some reason, I was in the back left bench as you're looking at the tent, and I was doing my stretches. So I was bending over, touching my toes, as Paul comes around the corner and literally ends up with his face about 1/2 a foot away from the bottom. and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, it's going to be a bad week. I'm kissing my ass goodbye." And he laughed and he walked off. But I found there was always plenty of time that I could lay down on the floor and stretch. But what was lovely is that every morning that we filmed, Sandy Toxwick will come in. So it was the first year it went to Channel 4. So there was Sandy and Noel as the presenters, and then Prue and Paul come in. Paul is actually a really nice guy and really cares about sharing his baking knowledge, and he is kind of generous with his time. Prue scared the bejesus out of me. I don't think she liked me. And she had that kind of right combination of being South African and a grandma that would just tell you exactly as it is, whether you're going to like it or not. So they edited her quite well, that she didn't sound as mean as some of the things she came out with. But again, an incredible talent, and was saying it from the right place, in that she wanted you to understand why it could be better or why it's good. But Sandy will come in. She was filming QI, and I've loved Sandy since she did, what was it, Number 54, that she filmed in Maidstone as like a kids program when Tiswas was out. And we always used to have a chat. She'd come up, she'd give you a big hug, and she was just a really nice, genuine person, and she settled your nerves. So she was really good fun. The challenges, the technical was always fun, because you've got no idea what it is, but you all meet in the bar on a Friday night, and you generally film your signature and your the technical on the Saturday, and then the showstopper on Sunday. So Friday night, all the bakers are like in the bar trying to guess what the technical could be. And I think we, in our season, we probably guessed it 7 out of 10 times right. it doesn't help you, because you've got no books. Like pudding week, it was one of those chocolate melting puddings. But the experience was phenomenal. It was stressful. Obviously, you can't tell anyone. So you go through the application process. I pushed the button on New Year's Eve. I knew I was on the show probably April time. Then you start getting the briefs, so you know what each episode is going to be, so you can start thinking about what you're going to bake.
Yeah.
Up to about May time, and I think we started filming late May, early June. But all through this time, you couldn't tell anyone. There's only one person. My boss at work knew. My wife knew. The kids were under NDAs, which was ridiculous because there was about 4. I'm not sure how that would hold
Don't
up.
Don't go telling anyone at nursery.
Yeah, exactly. So you become this kind of secretive baker. I was obviously, as you film from May then through to, I think we finished in, last one was in August, where they do the garden party where everyone goes back. So you're filming all through that period, and I'm away every weekend, basically, for 5-6 weekends. And I'm thinking, what are the neighbours thinking? Every weekend, I pack my bags and I go away. And then it's like, because we've got friends who live across the road, it's like, what do I say? And I said, the best thing to say is just, we're going through a bit of a troubled patch. They won't ask you anything else.
That's true. They ain't going to ask any follow-up questions.
Exactly, yeah.
Very
Make
confused
it
when you...
as possible. Yeah.
Very confused when you return covered in flour, but yeah.
Exactly, yeah. On biscuit week, sadly, we lost my wife's brother-in-law, so my wife's sister's husband, to prostate cancer just before we started filming. So we went to his funeral on the Friday, and I was and I had to be at the hotel Friday night. So we had to go in two cars. So we parked one and then joined up because I had all my baking equipment in one. And we had to leave together and then rendezvous at the kind of pick up the car at the garage that we left it at. And it was all secretive whilst we're going through a funeral. It was like the weirdest thing happening. And I had the biggest bag of kind of tins and bakeware stuff. So Anne and the kids headed home. I headed to filming. And Stacey, who was, she got trolled a lot, sadly, on the show, but she was kind of 50s Jewish mum. She was, I found her lovely, but she had a brilliant sense of humour. And she was just so kind, but it didn't really come across on the screen, which was unfortunate for her.
And I think there's always going to be one, isn't there, that unfortunately attracts the worst side of the internet.
Exactly. And I remember she was the first person at the hotel. I turned up with this huge bag. And the first thing she said to me is like, have you got a dead body in there? And that is exactly what I needed, just to kind of break myself out of the
mold
appearance. It's just like, you do realise I've just been to a funeral. She's like, oh, crap, no, you did tell me that. So we went to the bar and had a few G&Ts and had a good laugh about it. But it kind of broke the ice. But it was a phenomenal time. And then I was fortunate to get asked back to do the Christmas special. Yeah. And that was bizarre because that was filmed at Pinewood in July in a heat wave with snow, with sprayed snow all over the ground. Christmas trees. We had to wear like Christmas shirts and Christmas jumpers. And we were like dripping with sweat, trying to pretend we're cold. And that was nice because it didn't feel like a competition.
Yeah, I imagine that felt more like a social event.
Exactly. And I'm a bit of a James Bond geek, and where they film it is in the James Bond.
I was going to say, that's the only reason I know that I know of Pinewood is because that's where it's filmed, but I don't know it for anything else.
Yeah, so we got to look at the mansion that was in, what's the one with Oddjob where he throws his hat and they're playing golf? I think it's Goldfinger or one of those.
Right.
So we saw the mansions that they were creeping around. They were building the puppets for the Jurassic Park that was just coming out now in a hut that was just opposite the tent. So when they went home, we all like snuck over and was looking through the holes in the windows to see what they were building, which was phenomenal. I think they've done Tomb Raider there as well. So it was just lovely to geek out a bit. And again, I think we had Tom Allen there as a presenter because Noel had just had his second baby. And Matt as the other presenter.
Yeah.
And he was lovely as well.
Yeah, and Matt Lucas always comes across as a really nice chap. But one thing I feel like I've got around, and guys, this is clearly going to be, this bit is going to be like an extra for the podcast, I think. So feel free to bring questions at this point. And sorry to ask you to do this, James. If you need to get going, please do, because we've done the important conversation. Every time I watch Bake Off, it infuriates me when you get somebody who's really struggling and the words that come out of their mouth that just stagger me every single time is, I never tried this before. Like, is it because just the timing is so tight between weekends, or is that not an excuse? Because I never understand why people would put themselves through that when they've not tried something before.
Yeah, so the technicals, obviously, you've got no idea.
Yeah.
The thing that winds me up, though, is that you know at some stage there'll be shoe pastry on the show. It's through one of the things. And the amount of people go, I've never made shoe pastry before. It's just like, oh, come on, you watch the program. There's always shoe pastry coming. But you do get to a stage where, so you get two episodes worth of briefs every 2 weeks, but in effect, they're sending you briefs every week. It's just that you have to respond to them in 2 weeks' time, if that makes sense. And you've got about probably 4 to 6 weeks between that period where you've been picked and you start filming. So you have to develop your recipes. They have to be unique. So it takes a little bit of time to work out what you want to bake.
Yeah.
And then you need to practice it. And we were filming every weekend. So you get a little bit. So probably episodes 1 through 4 or 5, the first 1, 2, and 3, you probably tested really well.
Yeah.
When you get to 4 and 5, you probably made it once. And most people, if they're honest, they'll say, well, actually, if I don't, I don't think I'll get much further than 5, so I'm not going to worry too much about 6, 7, or 8. And then you luck through. So it does get harder the further you get through. Yeah. And you don't know the final showstopper or signature until a couple of weeks before. So you don't get a lot of time for that either.
Yeah, it will give people benefit. I assume just like if you're working in between a film and every weekend, that must become a bit of a runaway train. But you'd see people on like week 2 or 3, like, I haven't really tried this or prepared it. And I think maybe it's just me. I'm a bit of a prep. I'm not very good at doing things on the fly. So I don't think I'd do very well in the tent.
And I think, again, it depends. For me, the lockdown approach of filming it, which is similar to the way they film the US version of Bake Off, is that you're all in a hotel or wherever they're going to film it. Excuse me. And you're there for a couple of weeks to film so many episodes.
Yeah.
So you get a day or two's filming, then a day or two's baking. But you're there 100% of the time. Whereas how they filmed it all the way up to pre-lockdown was that you'd film every weekend. So I was working. There was the weekend that I talked about, Biscuit Weekend, where the funeral for work, I had to fly to Dublin on Monday and I was up in Wolverhampton on Wednesday. I just literally had no time to. I rang up my boss coming back from Wolves and said, I need to take Thursday off because I haven't tested anything yet. I haven't baked anything. And I went home and I baked what I wanted to do. And we was doing biscuit board games. I made Cop-It. And I made it, got halfway through it. It all failed. I threw it in the bin. I had the write up and said, I'm going home this week. I can't do it. And actually, in the tent, it all turned around. I had a brainwave of how to do it literally on. Whilst I was building it, that worked, and I was just fortunate. But there'll be some people who either don't have or retired. So Flo was retired, so she had plenty of time to practice. Katie, the Scouse lass, she worked in health and safety, and I remember her coming in one week saying, "Oh, it's been a terrible week. I've been investigating a health and safety thing. Someone lost their arm in like a printing press or something like that."
Wow.
If my week was bad, your week was terrible.
Yeah.
And people were like studying for MBAs. And it's really kind of tricky for some people to get the testing in. Other people had more time, but maybe didn't have the money because you only get a certain amount of.
I must admit, that was another sort of question we've had when we've watched it. It's like, how can you afford to actually practice a lot of those? Because unless you actually get a budget or anything, that's an expensive hobby at the best of times.
Yeah. Yeah, they do give a budget for testing for every 3 episodes, and it probably allows you to do 2 or 3 attempts at it, I'd say, roughly on average. But it can be tough, and if people haven't got a lot of money, they could be waiting on the expenses to come through to do the next 3 episodes testing.
Yeah.
It's an expensive hobby, definitely.
No,
nowadays, you'd need to take out a mortgage, I think.
Yeah. And that's before you've even turned the oven on. I suppose we should probably, I appreciate you've added all of that insight, which thank you. It's got nothing to do with the conversation we were having for the podcast. So I really appreciate you indulging us there.
You're welcome.
Do you want to just end by telling us a little bit about how baking, I suppose, is important to you? Because I'm going to probably assume it's filled that gap from your physical exercise and everything else. But do you want to just tell us a little about what you do now? Because obviously the stuff you share on Instagram is amazing. I can never watch it before I've eaten because it just makes me hungry. And maybe just let people know where they can find you, what you do, and how, and maybe probably more importantly, like how that has sort of filled that hole for you. Because I think I want people to know that just because you lose one hobby because of your condition, it doesn't mean it's the end of the road and there are other things out there, aren't there?
Definitely. So for me, I think I touched on it earlier with my running. That was about kind of getting some headspace. And I find baking has a very good mental health aspect to it that is very mindful. Kneading dough is just so relaxing. Again, I love baking with my kids, so it's a good space to catch up with them. There's no phones around. Great for talking with people. And it's quite fulfilling because you end up with something at the end that hopefully you can give to someone and they smile. And there's just something like bakers are generally feeders. They like to give food to people and make other people happy by giving those sorts of presents. So I find it really relaxing to bake. It's my kind of place that if I just need to switch off, I'll go and bake something. I really got into bread during lockdown, especially sourdough, like a lot of people did. And I found doing things like bread and croissants, I could change the way I was baking, because with pain in your lower back, leaning over the counter can be sometimes just as painful as going for a run. So I ended up working out how I could carry on baking with a minimal amount of pain. And sourdough was perfect, because you do 5-10 minutes worth of work, and then you can go and do something else. You can stretch and then you come back to it. So I ended up baking things that I could bake in different chunks of time and have breaks in between. So I could carry on doing it when I was having high pain days. Other days, if I was feeling better, I could just knock something out and kind of stay in the kitchen. But it's just being kind of mindful of how your body's feeling and what can you do to work around it. And baking is, there's so many options. It works out well for me.
It's giving you that headspace again, isn't it? Like you talked exactly. about earlier yeah. at the start, running.
Definitely. Sorry, excuse me.
Okay. So, yeah, so how can people find you and see all the awesome stuff you're making online?
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram, and my handle is CluckMuckCook. So I should have changed that before when I'm Bake Off, because then I don't have to explain it. So before Bake Off, I was on Instagram. Me and my dad have an allotment together. We had chickens. The cluck was the chickens. The muck was the allotment. And we used to cook fresh from whatever we were growing. Awesome. So that was the cluck muck cook. Obviously, not the most easy handle to find. But yeah, so I'm on
it's
Instagram.
Nice. It's got a story, though. There's lots of it there that, exactly. that don't.
So. Yeah, it means something. So, I do have a baking blog that I haven't updated recently, but I will get back to. So there's recipes out there. But if anyone's ever got any questions, my DMs are always open. I like to interact with the people who follow me and who enjoy baking or want to ask about the condition. So I'm always at the end of a DM. So feel free to give me a follow and reach out to me if you need me.
And I can testify for that. James sent me some lovely messages before. I shouldn't say this, but I used to watch the Bake Off all the while. When it went to Channel 4, I missed the first series back on Channel 4. I don't know why, just habit or whatever. So I completely missed it. And I had no idea who you were. I was just talking to you as another arthritis patient. And yeah, and James is really approachable and has answered any questions I've had. And I'm sure he'd do the same for you guys. If you are listening back to this on the podcast at a later date, in the show notes will be all of James's handles so you can click them and go straight through. So on behalf of everyone who's here live, James, on Twitch, and everybody that listens back to this, thank you ever so much for your time today, especially, like I say, for indulging us with the behind-the-scenes stuff with the Bake Off. That's been brilliant. There's been so many positive comments in the live chat. So, yeah, thank you for joining us and giving up your time this evening.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thanks for having me.